Welcome to Minority Corner, where we take an introspective look at the world through an intersectional lens. I'm James, he, him, his. I'm a queer, political, actor, activist, comedian, Cancerian, self-proclaimed, sexy blurred. That's a black nerd. And each week, I'm joined in the corner by another fabulous minority where we tackle the news, pop culture, politics, media, history, and more, all with a little self-care and self-love sprinkled throughout. This week, we've got joining us...
Hi, my name is Maury Minhas, she, her, relatively recent citizen of the U.S., a San Francisco native living in New York City for almost 12 years, multilingual, multicultural Bangladeshi-American. I love all things sciences, stress baking, archery, and a recent video game enthusiast.
Woof. Okay, so the DNC just wrapped, and... y'all, I need a breather. I cannot talk about this today. So today we are not going to debrief the DNC. We're going to save that for next week. So we're going to be flipping the script and we'll have a new episode into your listening devices and in your ear holes for next week, Tuesday. And we'll bump the Minority Corner Rewind or bonus episode that we've been doing. That will be on Friday. And we will have with us Minority Corner political expert Ben Randles. So we're going to take some time, process, and come back with a beautiful conversation around the DNC. Because, y'all, I'm emotionally drained. They took me on a Zoom PBS special news infomercial journey. And I don't know if it's the pandemic, fires that are happening here in California. Sidebar, I had family who was evacuated from their homes here in California. It was very scary. Yes, the environment is on the ballot. So we're going to take a beat to all the DNC goodness and things that are happening. And we'll do a big debrief on highlights, lowlights, gaffes, funny moments, moving moments. I think that there was a lot. What's next? Call to action. Things that we can do because it's all hands on deck. So that'll be coming at you on Tuesday. For today, something a little bit lighter before we roll up our sleeves and get to work. So Maury is back here and she and I sat down earlier and we dived into some of our favorite pieces of media that we have been gobbling up during the pandemic. And these shows are not only entertaining, but speak to the cultural zeitgeist. The Wire, which I finally sat down and watched, and I was warned it would ruin television for me, one of the best shows ever, and hands down, yes, correct. And how it's the only police show anybody ever needs to watch, and really gives you a deep understanding around what is plaguing societies post 9/11. And the fucked up police structures in underserved communities. We also jump into Westworld and The Old Guard. Let me tell you, with all this media, I am feeling so seen. And you've heard of the Bechdel test. Well, now there's one to measure queer representation, Russo test. And just when you thought we were just going to sit down all episode and have rainbows and teacups and lollipops, which I guess is a thing, I don't know. Well, Maury's going to take the reins and she is going to take us on a deep dive into the age-old problem of medicine, specifically with Black people not being served. Oh, yes, this has been happening systemically for decades. And it is something that Vice Presidential nominee Kamala Harris, that's fun to say, take a moment. That is a Black woman of color. Take a moment. That's dope. Well, she's been out consistently, one of the first candidates to really be speaking out on the issue, specifically as it pertains to the Black female mortality rate and just how my community is consistently being underserved. So Maury's going to tackle into the historical systemic issues around that. And how and why that continues to happen, because let's face it, healthcare is on the ballot and it is drastically disproportionately affecting Black folks in particular in a very negative way. So research extraordinaire Maury is going to take us through that. The facts, the stats, it's disappointing, it's alarming, it's a lot. healthcare is on the ballot. And if you think it can't get worse, oh, it can, unless we, the people, correct the course. All that and so much more. So excited to have you here with us on the show today. We got Maury in the house. Get ready to learn, laugh, and play right here on Minority Corner. So my company, they're like, don't forget to join. I'm going to be doing matching donations to this, you know, Black organization. I'm like, I don't need to give to that, but y'all can. Like,
yeah, I mean,
y'all should be giving me.
You pay in like being you. So
exactly. Similarly, like I finished my taxes. I ended up having to pay. I got fucked over on my Medicare. I'm not my Medicare, but like my medical. Apparently, like because I made a little bit more of the money than was projected, but not like $1,000 more. And so then I had to go back and just try and like it. It's frustrating because I'm like, great, I paid my taxes. Can the country work now? Like, and the fact that I got like my penalty was because of medical insurance is really frustrating because, well, what the fuck has my money been going towards?
Exactly. Because it's not
medical's right. Yeah. Like the country's falling apart. Like, where are my tax dollars? I'm happy to pay taxes. I won't say I love it, but I'm happy to. Actually, I do. I love it. I love contributing to my community and let's build some schools, build some roads, let's go. Mm-hmm. But I'm not seeing that. And it's very frustrating, especially when I know that there's these rich ass motherfuckers at the top who are not paying their fair share.
Yeah, the Jeff Bezos of the world. Yeah.
Well played. Yeah. Pay your fair shares. And that's another thing, too. It's just like, nobody in this, anybody who's a fucking billionaire, millionaire, you didn't make that. Every single company.
You did not. You were given that money, or you took ours.
Yes.
Our ancestors' money.
Yes. Or like you, how did you get to work? Or if it was delivery, and what were those roads? Those are tax dollar roads, or the information to do better marketing based on my data. Like every single successful company in this country, we all have helped build in some way or another. And we deserve a little bit of that piece of that pie. And really, it's so interesting if we can just, there's such enough resources in this country. There is a riches of abundance. We could have enough food. There could be enough shelter. Mm-hmm. There doesn't need to be this, you know, struggle. And it's sort of, I mean, that's what Star Trek is all about, is that we've all made it to this point where everyone's good and we can now go off and explore and do some other things, right? So it's like, you know, having a universal base income. Like if there's certain things that we're like food and shelter, everyone gets a base level of those, right?
Yeah.
But if you want a little bit more, then you're going to have to work a little bit more or create some sort of something for society that will then garner you extra income in that sort of facet. But everyone gets a base level. And if you want more, then you'll have to work a little bit more to get that, right?
Which is fair. That's fair.
Yeah, I think that totally makes sense.
And no one would complain about that because people are okay with it.
They'd be like, oh, okay, yeah, I understand that if I want to switch, then I need to work to be able to, you know, earn that and get that, right?
Yeah.
Like, and so we could imagine the pressure that we would take off, and we would then benefit because there's so many brilliant minds that are trapped in the struggle and survival of life.
Yeah.
And there's so much that's also wasted. So it's like, you know, if you don't have to focus about food and shelter, your brain can do other things and we then benefit. So
yeah,
I don't know how I got on that tirade, but fuck taxes. Also, like there's my reparations. Like, I shouldn't have to pay taxes. Like, it should be.
Yeah.
I shouldn't. My ancestors built this country.
I mean, I don't understand how. No, you know what? I can't. We can't go into it. It's a big. It's a huge, like, that's another black hole of things that.
Fuck you, taxes. We'll just right there. Okay. I want to just. I was trying to figure out how to quantify who am I, like a professor. I was listening to an interview with Tessa Thompson, and she used the word quantify. I'm like, okay, girl, you're intelligent. We got it. But speaking of Tessa Thompson, there's a few pieces of media that I wanted to talk to you about that I know that you had seen. And I just, I feel like it's been speaking to the zeitgeist of not only are they entertaining, but they're also saying something.
Let's hear it.
So the first one I wanted to dip into in was Westworld season 3. I finally just finished. And yeah, it's weird. A lot of people have been, not a lot of people, but some of the people I've been hearing, they're like over it and don't like it. And
I thought it was, I really liked this season.
Same. I really
enjoyed it. And I thought the storytelling was better.
Agreed, yeah.
And you see the characters, not just the human characters, but what do you call them? Not androids.
Androids? Yeah, that's
Are
right.
Are they androids?
I think they're the droids.
Hosts?
The robot. Hosts. Oh, the hosts. Yeah.
Yeah. Like,
I was like, Android, you mean the iPhone? Yeah. They're just walking iPhones. They really are. That's the future of the
basically,
iPhone.
But the hosts...
Dolores,
they,
what's the weather today?
Exactly. But they, you know, you see them kind of developing and evolving as well, which was really interesting. And you can see how what, like, the certain traits that make them human and how that's evolving, which was really, I really liked it. I thought it was
I did too. Actually,
season.
I would wager that it probably was one of my more so favorite seasons because... Not only the themes, I think there's such a great theme that is developed. There's a few different themes that I think are developing, and I think they went even deeper with this next season. And so it's sort of like free will. So this idea of free will. And so at first you thought watching Westworld season 1 and 2, like how much free will do the host have, right? But then you get to season 3 and it turns out that all of the humans don't have free will because of this machine that is essentially running their lives based on an algorithm, which tells you what you can and can't do, what you you can be, what you can't. And so then I think it's another conversation about just sort of like, it's literally just the warning signs of data and data collection.
Yeah.
You know
what,
algorithms.
What, you know what this reminded me of too? Have you seen the movie Gattaca?
Where I haven't, but isn't that where you can like create your baby, like, you know, mix
well,
and match?
Well, it's not, I mean, that's just like a little part of it, okay. But basically it's like...
To me, I thought that was the entire thing of the movie. Was like losing Isaiah meets like, you know, Gigapet where you design your own baby.
No, so it's basically they like test your blood and then they determine what you can or cannot be, basically. Mm. Like kind of like pan out this life for you. So like there's no free will, basically. Like you can't really strive to or aspire to be something because it's already predetermined for you.
Gotcha.
But yeah, it's really good. You should watch it. It has like Ethan Hawke, Uma Thurman, and young Jude Law.
Oh, well, I love an Uma Thurman and an Ethan Hawke who then had a wonderful baby who I hope that if they do a Kill Bill Volume 3 and they have Uma Thurman's character Beatrix's daughter, they should have her real life daughter play the part
because
she was in Stranger Things the third season. She was phenomenal in it. She's a great combination of both Uma Thurman and Ethan Hawke. Like just
So I think this is similar to what they kind of make you go through with season 3.
And I think the other thing that I really liked about season 3, I think the reason why I was dragging my heels on season 1 is like, for me, honestly, anytime I have to watch something and it's like about white dudes doing things, I'm uninterested. Mm-hmm. And when women are sidelined, I'm not interested. And like the most interesting, compelling characters for me from the beginning were always Thandi fucking Newton's Maeve, right?
Yeah.
And I felt like, I think that they're, I don't know if this was always in their original plan, but what they have done with Thandi Newton, her character, and like also if you look at season 3, there are 3 black women featured prominently in it. Lena Waithe's character, Tessa Thompson's character, which Tessa Thompson's another example of like, I don't know if that was the original plan for her or because she's blown up as an actress, she's gotten such a much larger part, right? And Thandi Newton as well, who just, her character was always so captivating. And and then also Dolores just seeing her journey of where it's gone, like I just seeing that, like seeing them fight against each other was just, I don't know, I love women kicking ass, and so getting to watch them have their amazing host fight sequences was just, And it was so great because I feel like it built up since season two, where they're, because they didn't really have any interaction with each other. In season two, their paths cross, and then
yeah,
she's like, that's not my journey. Sorry, good luck, Dolores. Yeah. I'm going to get my daughter, right? And then having it come full circle where they fight each other. And then, but then it's like, uh-oh, women are fighting against each other. Come on. And then they...
No, I think I appreciated the fact that, like, you know, I think naturally we want, like, well, they're both hosts, they're both females, like, why can't they just get along and work together? But, like, that's not always going to be the case in real life either, you know?
Right.
So, like, they both had their own motivation and their own goals. And
yeah, and I actually think the show kind of discusses that. I feel like there's a monologue or something where Thandie Newton's character Maeve even says, she's like, I never really understood Dolores. Like, mm-hmm. we just really were in our two different worlds. Mm-hmm. But then they do have, they come to a point where there's a bit of an understanding. And I just, I think that was one of my favorite seasons. I think it just took, I love, also too, like, I'm not a big fan of, like, old-timey things, like, the West, like, it's
dirty.
Yeah,
me either.
I love future, give me some future stuff. Yeah. That just seems so much more interesting to me. I think that's also because, like, I don't exist in a West, I don't exist in old-timey places, right?
Exactly.
So it's, like, a hesitancy to want to, like, travel back to that. But, like, the future is like, ooh, what could this be? This could be anything.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Definitely. Yeah, so, that's definitely why I liked the third season better.
Well, then jumping off of that and talking about science fiction movies set in, I guess, the future. I actually know this one, not necessarily the future, but science fiction movies that feature badass women, women of color, The Old Guard on Netflix with Charlize
Theron. Oh, my
God.
It was so much fun. I mean, you kind of pushed me into, like, make sure you watch it. And I was, because I was telling you that, like, I don't really feel like starting a new show. I need something that's,
like, it's
quick.
A movie.
Yeah. And yeah, oh my God. I enjoyed it to its fullest. And I can't,
enjoyed
I'm like waiting patiently, not so patiently, for whatever the next installment's going to be. Because
yeah, well, whenever they can film it, with,
yeah,
you know, it might be a long time, pandemic life.
Oh, God. Yeah, but yeah, it was so good. It was kick-ass main character being the kick-ass female character. And then, like, there's this just not overtly, like, in-your-face gay couple. Because, like, I feel like sometimes movies tend to do that where they, like, prominently make it so that they're, like, like, oh, okay, we get it. You know, like, you made an attempt to put a gay couple in. But, like, here, it was so natural because it's supposed to be natural. It's not supposed to be something that gets, like, pushed to the front all the time.
Well, interesting that you bring that up. So this kind of goes on to, so GLAAD had its annual report. And, well, okay, so there's, so we've, you know about the Bechdel test, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the Bechdel test is essentially if there are, it's a test that a lot of movies don't pass, and it talks about just, like, female representation. So for a movie to pass the Bechdel test fully, it has to have 3 points where there are at least 2 women in the movie, they both have names, and they talk to each other for at least 1 minute, not about a man. And you look at that and you're like, that seems so simple. How does
the bar is low?
Small percentage of movies are able to pass that very base thing. And then there's also now a Vito Russo test for LGBTQ characters. And that is that the characters are identifiably queer. They are not defined solely by their queerness. And if they were removed...
That's what I was trying to say.
Yeah. And if they were removed from the movie, it would affect the plot. And it's so interesting because if you take these two characters out of the movie, then the movie doesn't make any sense.
It doesn't make sense, yeah.
It was so heartwarming because there's only one sort of romantic relationship in the entire, really, kind of really only one romantic relationship in the movie, and that's these two guys. And what I love is that the author of it, so this is, The Old Guard is based on a graphic novel by Greg Rucka. He also wrote the movie for Netflix. So that's what I love too, is that it's like the guy who wrote the source materials also on board for the actual movie. And he said that for the movie to happen, that these two characters and their gay relationship had to be in the movie. he would not allow for it to be done if they weren't going to be in the movie. And because it was so, he wanted to show that, like, you know, so this, the movie is essentially about people who are quote unquote kind of immortal. And it's this diverse cast of people. So he wanted to make sure that it didn't signify that, like, you had to be like a white guy, you know, to be an immortal, that it could be anybody of any gender, any, you know, race, any religious background. And two, what I love is that, like, that just, it's so nonchalantly done. Like, the first time you maybe realize that maybe they are, is that there's a scene when they're all sleeping on the train and two of the guys are cuddling and you're like, oh, right. And it just sort of, just naturally introduces it and doesn't make a big deal out of it. Like you were talking about.
Yeah. And then they mention, God, I'm blanking on the main character's name, but her relationship with Quinn, who's another character.
Charlize Theron's character with, with Quinn. Yeah, that maybe they had some sort of deep connection.
Yeah. Andy, right? That's right.
Yeah, Andy, yeah. Cause
that, no, I was just saying that. Yeah. So they succeeded in kind of depicting two relationships, but... Yeah, the prominent one, you're absolutely right, that if they weren't there, it wouldn't make sense, and the story wouldn't make sense.
And I want to give snaps because the movie was directed by Gina Prince-Blythewood, who did For Love and Basketball, Beyond the Lights. She was slated to direct Silver and Cat. I think that's what it was called. It was going to be in the Spider-Man cinematic universe, not to be confused with the Marvel cinematic universe. But it was going to be about Silver Sable and Black Cat, and she was going to direct that movie and ended up, you know, not going forward with it. And so I'm just grateful to see what she wanted to do with an action film. And it being so grounded, it's like you and I both love the genre of action and sci-fi, right? Mm-hmm. We've been here for day one. But how often do we get to see representations that we connect with? It's usually a lot of straight white dudes running around
always,
doing stuff.
Always, yeah.
And this movie was the complete opposite, where it's like you had the old mentor and the young protege were both women. And there's the fight sequence between Charlize Theron and I forget the name of the girl, but she's, you know, this young Black American who was fighting in the military. And there's even a scene when she's off in, you know, the Middle East fighting, and she's with two other women. Like, they're their own sort of, like, I don't know the word, battalion or whatnot, but they're on a mission. And I just appreciated seeing even that. But there's a really dope fight sequence. It's sort of like the formula of all these different action movies that you've seen before, and just taken with different people in those spots that you normally don't get to see. And then the depth, too. There's like a certain depth that they're able to bring to it, because it's just so layered that I felt like every character was so grounded. Everyone was, you know, dealing with their conflicts of having this power and not wanting it. And what does it mean to be living for all this time and not seeing any, you know, changes really happening, you know, throughout the world? You're fighting for a world that just seems like it's constantly decaying.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think highly recommend it for people too.
So good. Make more, sure. More, more. I think it did really, Netflix is very shy. They don't like to tell about their numbers, but I think it's done incredibly well, and I anticipate more.
Yeah.
Last thing I want to talk about is digging into the archives. And this is kind of the thing that kicked off my quarantine viewing. Mm-hmm. I want to talk about The Wire. Let me sing the theme song. Jazz music and jazz. Oh, and then it's different for every season. Then it's just sometimes like, ooh, jazz.
You gotta walk through the garden, right? That's
you gotta walk through the garden, and then you gotta walk through the garden. You gotta walk through the garden. But I love that, like,
oh my God.
What I love is that just the wires that, like, every season it was the same theme song, but sung by a different genre and artist. I thought that was so cool.
Yeah. Love it.
Oh man, The Wire. So everyone is always talking about, oh, The Wire. The Wire is the best show ever. Oh, if you watch The Wire, it'll ruin television for you. The Wire, right? And I'm like, listen, people, I've seen TV. I get it.
It can't be that good. That's especially what I used to think.
Especially you think, like, oh, it's like a cop crime drama.
Yeah, like we've seen that before.
And little did you know, that's how it gets you, because it is not that at all.
Yeah.
And like some, it ruined television for me because I'm like, nothing is as good as The Wire, where everything in The Wire seems so planned out. What I love is that they'll be like, a character will have like one line, season one, episode four, and then come back like, you know, a few episodes later or next season, and they're like a main character.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And you're like, oh, okay, that's where they were going with that, you know, one throw off line or something, you know?
Yeah, no. And it's, I'm not done with it yet. I know you are. But you can tell it, this is, you know, I was talking to my friend who's, you know, he's a director and he like knows a lot about film. And he was saying that the movie, it, not the movie, the show was created as like an answer to a movie sort of thing. Instead of making a movie, they just cut it up in like, what is it, like 12 episodes? But it's filmed like a movie at that time, at least. And when it was out, at that time, TV did not have a show like this where it was filmed like this or it was presented like this. So,
right, because it definitely is a bit of, it's a slow burn and it rewards audiences for going along with it. And in fact, the creator, Simon something or other, let me see, David Simon, he used to be a journalist in, I think he was a journalist in at the Baltimore Sun, which will make sense when you get to season five. This isn't a spoiler, but what I love is like every season kind of takes place at a different part of Baltimore where there's not really a main character really in the show. The main character is Baltimore, the city of Baltimore, you know?
Yep.
And like the first season, it's these, you know, cops who are doing this wire on this, you know, these drug dealers. And then the second season, it's the labor union and these guys at the docks who have these connections to actually how the drugs are actually even coming into the country, which is from this sort of Greek mafia. And then the third season, you've got this guy who's running for mayor, wanting to make these changes. And then this detective who's this police, this who's trying to make these changes because the war on drugs is bullshit. Like, it's unwinnable. And so what about, and this is actually based on, a lot of the stuff is based on real shit that happened in Baltimore that the creator, David Simon, said that he wanted to create something authentic. He wanted people who lived in Baltimore to be able to see it and be like, that is real. So he took from sort of real life. He hired writers who used to write for like the Baltimore Sun. And based on a lot of the experiences and things that he had heard or experienced. And this fourth season goes into the schools. And it's almost the most pearl-clutching season to me because you now know the world that exists, right? In Baltimore. And then seeing it focused on these four kids who are in like junior high, you're scared for everybody. Like,
yeah, you're, and then you're the like, what's going to happen to them?
And the fifth season takes it on towards sort of the newspaper. And I think that one of the central themes of, you know, this show takes place after 9/11 and you still had Ronald Reagan's war on drugs, you know, raging and going. But yet then we also had the war on terror. And so there's this focus on the war on drugs is still going on where it's this expectations of like numbers and arrest and da 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 da. Right.
Yeah.
But all the funding is now being directed towards the war on terror. And it's a great like example of just the decay of America and just the American dream and how and why it's dead. Everything that's going on right now, I'm so glad I watched The Wire because I'm like, well, that's why that's happening. When you're talking about like why police are arresting people at the rate that they're doing or focusing on certain communities or people or why there's not funding for schools or organizations, you watch The Wire and you're like, oh, I understand how every single city operates and works and why this happens.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's it captured a part of our society that like we thought we knew, but we knew nothing about. And you know, yeah, it takes place in Baltimore, but like you said, it can be anywhere.
Yeah.
Any big like metropolitan location.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, I'm afraid of what's no spoilers from
I'm
you.
I'm not
but,
gonna
like,
say anything.
I'm just afraid of what's gonna like I hope the kids I'm you know, like when you get attached to like characters.
Yeah.
Oh I mean, God, like, yeah. I got attached to a character earlier in the show, and And then, like, I'm so sad.
Was it Idris Elba? I hope
it was not him. It was not him.
I am not a fan of Idris. I think it spawned for the last time you were here, but I realized how much, like, I don't care about Idris Elba. Like, I am off put by that man. Good for you. You're cute and British and sexy, but, like, I don't give two shits about Idris Elba.
Something about him that just doesn't click for you.
Exactly. And spoiler alert, when he dies in season 3.
Oh my God.
I did not care. Good. Let's keep the show going. Don't care. Yeah. And I think the heads of HBO thought the show, because that was Idris Elba's like first sort of big role. Michael B. Jordan is in there. Like the cast is so phenomenal. And it's so interesting too, because it's like, the show got popular after it ended. It took people through word of mouth to come and find it. And it's also too, because it's like HBO at the time was focusing so much on The Sopranos. Like, it's weird that The Wire was never nominated, didn't win any fucking awards. And it's one of the best acted, written shows ever.
Crazy.
Wasn't getting any sort of that attention, but that's because so much of HBO's focus was on The Sopranos, which focused on white people doing crime, right? And this... is such an interesting thing because it also talks about the psychology of like, well, why are people dealing drugs? Like, what's going on in their community? But until you get to the fourth season, you see kind of what is happening with the youth and the journey that they go on, and that like the good guys are not always the good guys and the bad guys are sometimes people who are actually really trying to do good.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, this show is the show that you will never be able to kind of pinpoint who's good or bad. Right. I mean, one of the big...
humanity of it all.
Yeah. One of the main characters is Omar, and like...
Omar's so good.
He's supposed to be the quote-unquote bad guy, but then like he's one of my favorite because he really isn't bad.
He's a Robin Hood type guy.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, he's like robbing these, you know, drug dealers, and that's what he's doing. And like, also pausing the action, because again, this show is so revolutionary. It's what, 2001? And yeah. Omar's this gay, like, guy. He's this gay, like, I don't know, gangster guy who's robbing other gangsters who are drug dealers, you know? Like, holy fuck, like, I didn't know that this was in existence. There's also, you know, Kima, who she's a lesbian detective. Apparently, she originally was supposed to be killed in season 1, and then they ended up keeping her around because they, you know, she's a great actress, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's just, like, the show is so groundbreaking on so many different levels, and I think takes, like, this is the only kind of crime, quote-unquote, drama that we need to see anymore.
Yeah.
Because I think what it does is it talks about crime, but the ripple effects of like crime doesn't just happen, right? And I think so many times in politics or in society, we just try to put band-aids at things. But this show dives into not just the symptoms of what's plaguing society, but the cause and the root of it. And so that's why it's like, I couldn't even look at like CSI the same again, right? Because it's like, it's so one-sided.
So fluffy. Those other cop shows are fluffy because it doesn't delve into anything.
Yep.
But they're also on the model of like Monster of the Week sort of thing. So
right. Yeah. And this show dives in even deeper into that universe and world. I would love for them to actually do a reboot of it, bringing it back and in today's world. Because one thing that it doesn't really talk about too much, because those conversations weren't happening, but like, you know, the shooting of unarmed black men, it would be interested to... It's there, and you know it exists in the world of The Wire. You can feel it's palpable, and you know that it's there. But there's not really a plot line that really dives into that, and I think that would be really interesting to explore.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you should write to them.
Okay.
Hi.
Dear David Dear Simon. Oh, yeah. I was right to the Wire. Dear The Wire. I think you should come back. I'll just tweet at them. That usually works.
Oh, yeah. I did watch Yvonne Orja.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Her special. Yeah. Ugh, hilarious.
So good. She's so funny.
She's funny.
I finished the... because I had my cousin... my cousin also watched, and he had never seen anything of Yvonne. I think he'd seen me watching a few episodes of, like, Insecure. Mm-hmm. But he had no other really connection to her at all. And that's how you know that that stand-up is so funny, when it's like you don't even know who this person is, and you're able to watch and just, like, laugh your ass off. Like,
yeah.
Oh, same thing with my sister. I had my sister watch it, too. And
same thing with Chris. When I watched it, he watched it. Because he doesn't watch Insecure with me. I watched that by myself, but he watched the stand-up and it was hilarious. And you know what's funny is that, like, the immigrant experience is very, very much, like, true, you know. Totally. It's very true for, you know, like, non-Black immigrants as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Sort of those parental expectations.
Oh yeah, exactly.
Yeah, she's so funny. I had no idea she was from the sort of stand-up comic world, and, like, she kills it. A really great HBO special. And in fact, I think Amanda Seales also has you can just have a night of stand-up comedy from Insecure. Like, get into it.
Yeah.
Okay, all right. Well, shall we get into the main corner?
Main corner.
All right.
One, two, one, two, three. Hi, everybody. My name is Justin McElroy.
I'm Sydney McElroy.
We're both doctors. And
nope, just me.
Okay, well, Sydney's a doctor, and I'm a medical enthusiast, and we create Sawbones, a marital tour of misguided medicine.
Every week, I dig through the annals of medical history to bring you the wildest, grossest, sometimes dumbest tales of ways we've tried to treat people throughout history.
And lately, we do a lot of modern fake medicine, because everything's a disaster, but it's slightly less of a disaster every Friday, right here on MaximumFun.org, as we bring you Sawbones, a marital tour of misguided medicine. And remember,
don't drill a hole in your head.
Okay, so my corner is
Maurice Cordner. She's gonna learn you today. You're gonna transplant some knowledge into our brains.
Oh, that's great. Oh my god, that's amazing. It's amazing because I work at a transplant center. Yeah, I mean, my corner's gonna be pretty depressing, but
All right, good. That's, you know, I like a little preparation. That way you need to know, like, how to, like, brace yourself, you know. It's like when the wave is coming, we just hold on.
As I was researching this topic, I realized how depressing and how spread the problems are that are all funneling into this one issue.
Right.
So I wanted to discuss the age-old problem in medicine, which is Black people are not being properly served. So
a tale as old as American time.
Exactly. So this all started because due to George Floyd's death and all of the protest that's been happening and all of the coverage, it kind of came out and to the front of this inequality, even within our institutions. And one of the thing that our center, a few of our Black clinicians decided that we need to do more than just talk about how hurt we are feeling, and do more for their patients and for themselves. And one of the things that they wanted to do was create this initiative to better serve the Black population who are not being reached. So
first of all, I want to give, like, all the snaps right there, because, like, first of all, one, that your company was having these conversations, and then not only, like, having them, and then, like, okay, now what are we going to do? Like, what are our action plans and actually doing something? Because, like, don't just talk about it, be about it. So, like, that is amazing. And I think, like, every job, every corner of the country has something that they can be doing. So everyone has something that they can be doing. And I love that.
Yeah. And these, all three of them are Black women. One of them is a doctor of nurse practitioning, and The two other ones are, I believe, nurses. Either way, they, you know, they took a moment to kind of collect themselves. And then their next move was, now we have to, like, act and do something. Yeah. So, you know, I reached out to them and I wanted to get involved and et cetera. And so a few weeks after that, the transplant team has a psychiatrist, a doctor who reached out to me and was like, well, let's figure out how your team can get involved, blah, blah, blah. And then he was kind of like talking to me about some studies. And as we were talking about the studies, it was a particular data set that looked at alcoholic cirrhosis of the liver. And we found out through that, through looking at those numbers, that overall, just like we were talking about how like alcoholic cirrhosis affects everyone kind of the same way, but like we don't get enough Black patients at our center to help them out, blah, blah, blah. And then as we were looking at these numbers, we realized that like we knew the amount of Black transplant patients were much lower than the rest of the population, or even compared to the white population. But we didn't realize, I didn't realize how low it was. It's only 11% of the transplant population are Black transplant patients. So it, you know, so this is really a necessary initiative, because we have to make sure that like all these people are reached and they have a path to the center, the specialized center.
Right.
So one of those thing is that we were trying to identify. So what are the barriers? And a few of the barriers are like the access, right? So how are the patients accessing the specialized center? And this is not just for transplant. If you think about it, it could be like a cancer center or Alzheimer or any of that.
And you better hope that like your city or area even has one of those centers.
Exactly.
Because I would imagine if I'm in a rural area or an underserved area in communities, because like, so much right now of the medical industry seems to be about being a business and, and profit. And so sometimes it's like if they're not filling up beds, then they're like, well, we're not going to have people coming in here if there's not people who are using these services, as opposed to like they should be there because if someone needs them, and that's why there should be more subsidized medical care.
Exactly. So that's something I'll touch up on within this. And so one of the ways these specialized centers get their patients is that we get referrals from the primary care or the local clinics. Now, if the patients are not going to primary care or have access to those little clinics, then we're not going to get those patients out. Mm-hmm. And another thing is, even if they exist in those areas, a primary care, small clinic or whatever, then it's like it depends on the clinician to properly identify the patient's need and the patient, and then refer that patient. But the problem here is that unfortunately there's a lot of implicit bias and a lot of like unspoken racism when it comes to identifying patient's needs.
You know, when I had a brief stint as a role of I was hired as an actor to help doctors with their trainings, where they have to do trainings with different right? And so I have a tummy ache or something, and they have to sort of, you know, figure it out. But part of it is why they cast a diverse group of actors to play these parts, and part of it, what they're training them on, is for racial bias. And
exactly.
So they're looking into that. So I thought that was really cool at that program. I ended up doing it because I was too busy with other things. But I was grateful to see that at this specific medical training program that they were doing this.
Yeah. So it like kind of the lack of understanding of Black patients or not believing them when complaints are reported or pain is reported, it plays a huge role. So I delved into that of, I will provide the sources, but there are a few really great sources. And one of the things I looked into was how are we failing the Black patients who are in pain. And it's because there's this myth of Black people have thicker skin or have like higher threshold of pain, or they have less sensitive nerve ending, or you know, these like crazy myths.
I was gonna say these archaic science that, you know, how things just get passed down and not challenged again. I mean, this sounds like some exactly. Venus Hottentot science, you know?
Yeah. Oh yeah. And so some of the things I found was that as recently as 2016, about 40% of the first and second year medical students endorsed these myths. Because we like to think that, like, yeah, I mean, yikes. we like to think that, like, oh, these are old way of thinking, these will die off, and like the younger generations are, you know, we are better than this and blah blah blah.
Apparently,
because it took root in such way that like it is still being perpetuated, and it is, you know, hopefully not, but it will keep being the way it is, and it will keep being perpetuated because it's a very strong root. And you know, people are trying, and one of the things that they're doing, like you said, is like providing training for new clinicians.
No more of this, you know. I think no more will I even use the joke about someone being a strong Black woman, because that is dangerous.
So like the lack of understanding of patients, a Black patient's pain, that just has such a huge impact on disparities. So, you know, like I said, it will affect Black mothers' mortality rate, right? It affects, so I have some quick stats. I like to give you some numbers.
I love some numbers, and I love some stats.
Yeah, and they have sources too.
Step me up.
I'm just not making them up. So Black people are 3 times more likely to die from asthma as white compared to white people. Asthma, like, that's like, you think that's well controlled, and that shouldn't be a reason.
I have asthma.
Exactly.
I think statistically we're more likely to even have asthma.
Yeah. So the source that this is from, the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, from the Office of Minority Health. And then here's another one. Black people have 25% higher cancer death rate than their white counterpart. This is from National Cancer Institute. It's also because their cancer is diagnosed late that by the time they get to a specialist, it's too late.
That breaks my heart. That is exactly, my uncle died 4 years ago. He was diagnosed with cancer, and within 6 months he was gone. It happened so fast.
Yeah,
probably like it was just caught so late.
So late, yeah. And Black women have 20% higher cancer death rate than white women because, again, strong Black woman myth. It's you know, it's a strong Black woman is a great way to like uphold someone, sure, but when it comes to pain and when it comes to medical care,
and they've had to be strong Black women because they had to fend and care for themselves underneath a society that didn't give two shits about them and didn't even barely think that they were human. So, like, why don't we take off some of that burden from them, right? Let's take off some of that weight and let's be there for this underserved community. And there's been a lot of cancer scares in my family with a lot of the women in it, but luckily there's a lot of the women in my family have worked in the medical field, so they know, they get checked out on the reg.
Exactly. So in line with that, the last one I'm going to give you is Black people develop chronic diseases earlier in life. But because they're not being taken care of, they end up having shorter life expectancy. Oh, so you would think that, you know, you have something that's like chronic, something maybe as benign as like asthma, right? Mm-hmm. That you diagnose early in the life. Oh, if you could diagnose it earlier in life, then you would be able to like manage it. But because they develop early, but they don't get diagnosed early, it's kind of like, it's just sad that like the it just goes back to even the life expectancy is shorter. Yeah. That stat is from Population Reference Bureau. So
you made me think, because I think part of the reason why some, like, you look at the, I forget the name of it, like environmental racism, right? So the same thing you kind of hear with like, that happens with these First Nations people, but like a lot of the community, like Black people are more likely to live near like a chemical plant, you know, or living near landfills or different things, or just really places where human beings shouldn't be needing to live, or where they'll build some of this stuff, or where, you know, you saw what happened with Flint, Michigan, with the water being contaminated, you know? So it's no wonder that they're having these worst health conditions, and then there's they're not getting the treatment that they need to get, and you also don't have a medical care system that can even treat them. What the fuck is this country?
I know. It's
held together with like Band-Aids and gum. And Band-Aids that barely even match our skin tones.
Exactly. Oh my God. Yeah, I mean, it's just like mismanagement of everything, but it's like so insidious, I think, because it involves like people's like well-being and livelihood. And it's also, you know, we have to remember this has a lot of socioeconomic aspect to it too, like you were saying, like where people are living and things like that. So the implicit bias, right? So that's one of the things that that was brought up over and over throughout this research I did. They did in 2012, they did a study where they simulated a case where, or not a case, but a simulated a situation where pediatric clinicians looked at African-American teenager and white teenager post-surgery to see how they treat them. This is simulated.
They haven't actually even gone through it, but it's just like, let's play make-believe and see.
See how you react, how you handle this.
Become biased or racist.
And the result from that was that Black patients were 22% less likely than white patient to receive any pain medication. Oh, so again, goodness. It really
and this is just a simulation.
Goes back. Yeah.
It's not even real.
which means that it is happening, obviously happening in real life.
Yeah.
Maybe even
to a worser extent, because that was in a simulation where people were trying to be perfect and do it right.
Yeah. So this implicit racial biases, the thing with that is like, you know, we try to think of clinicians, doctors, nurses as like someone who should be above these kind of things, right? That they should be doing, they should have the critical thinking skills and they should be better people, but they're just like us. I mean,
they're humans living in this fucked up world, watching up television and movies.
Exactly. So they're also susceptible, and they're not immune to the stereotypes and the images that are portrayed in the media, right? So like all this like images of like, oh, like Black people are tougher, or you know, they are more susceptible to addiction, you know, that sort of like images that are portrayed in the media, it has a huge impact. And also there's this thing called in-group bias, which is they identify more with one's own group. So influences that influences the provider, so the nurses or the doctors' ability to assess pain. In 2019 study asked subjects to identify pain expressed in a photo. So they gave them photos of patients, and white participants readily recognized pain in white patient photos, which they did not do in black patients. So like even like visually, fine.
Oh, that's just how she looks. Oh, she good.
Yeah, basically yeah. Like, so,
God, that's terrible.
Yeah. So I told you this is this is going to get depressing.
it's good. It's a good depressing. Yeah. Not like it's a good, and, like, oh, I'm glad I know this. Also too, I'm going to say this, Maury, what I appreciate that you're pointing out, it's that thing that like I said, that I've said this a few times on the show, that racism has been like this sort of in the ether, and you're helping us to put a name to it. Like, oh, we're not making this up. That like, yeah. I know so many people who have gone to the doctor and they're like, oh, you're fine. Or like, mm-hmm. just how systemic the racism really is. It's like, it's mm-hmm. even in our medical care, that there is no stone left unturned, where it's like,
yeah,
you can't, no one can just say, oh, I don't see color, or I don't see racism. Well, then your eyes are closed.
Yeah. I mean, it's, if anything, it's really, really embedded in the medical field. And I will go more into that now.
Yeah.
So, you know, so that's like one of them is that like the way that the clinicians are treating patients. And another one is this lack of trust that black patients have for the medical professions, right? Professionals. And that, you know, some of the things are like greed, like you were saying, clinicians show lack of interest or understanding if the patient doesn't have insurance, because they're thinking insurance is like a point of revenue. And if a patient doesn't have an insurance, like, why would I even put my effort into that's, you know, I'm just mm-hmm. assuming, like thinking out loud here, like how that's how they're treating their patients. It's like, this person's not going to make me money, so who cares? Or like, why would I put so much effort?
I would love to see the guy who did The Wire do like could be another season of The Wire or a show, because yeah. then it could go even bigger, where I'm sure that's from like the higher ups who are getting budget slashed, and they're now trying to like The Wire has allowed me to see, okay, like, what are the proper larger levels of that, mm-hmm, of where those mm-hmm. ideas are coming from, where it's even
exactly.
the heads of the hospital who are like, the board is like, oh, well, you need to do this. And then there's probably yeah. someone who was on the board who wanted to do good, but then the system is just so fucked up that they can't.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, so the greed aspect, because it's managed care that are for profit. We have a for profit healthcare, which makes so absolutely sad. No sense.
Does that, you work in the healthcare industry, how do you feel? Is that hard? Because you're there because you care and you want to help people.
Most of the clinicians are good people who care and who yeah. want to do the best, and right. you know, they put themselves through years of education and spent all that money, but like at the end of the day, you're right, like if the higher ups who are the business people, if they're not letting them do those things, they can't. And it has been the complaints of a lot of clinicians, I think, where they feel like, I came into this industry to make a difference, and I can't do it because of the red tapes.
Yeah. Yeah. It makes me think of too, like, you hear that from teachers who, like, they came in because mm-hmm. they care, but because budget cuts and having to teach to the test, they can't do what they want to do. Mm-hmm. It's just like,
exactly.
literally, the like, at every corner, the infrastructure of this country is crumbling because it's so much about what makes money. And that is so ass backwards.
Mm hmm. Yeah, so another aspect of like the lack of trust in medical professionals, it comes from the history of experimentation. And I know that, you know, you guys have already talked about a few of this already, but just to lightly touch up on it, the belief that clinicians are experimenting on black people is very it's pretty strong in black community, and that's not just like a made up thing. It's rooted in real mm-hmm. history, like you said, in Tuskegee Institute from 19 1932 to 1972, there was a clinical study of untreated syphilis in African American males. The participant was, they were told that they're just getting a free healthcare. I mean, why not, right? We like free. And but what they were doing was just like seeing the effect syphilis has on untreated people. And what that did was it royally made everyone just extremely sick and died from it. And like,
yeah, totally.
And they, even when penicillin became available, they were not given the kind of like what is the standard of care. They were not even given the standard of care at that point because right. these people were more interested in seeing like the experiment play out.
I mean, you have to like not see someone as a human being at that point.
Exactly. Exactly. That's what it comes down to. It's the lack of, like, you can't identify with someone and that therefore you do these things. And that's right. that's like what it is. And there's more American history of mistrust.
It kind of just reminds me of like, it's not enough to say I'm not racist, but be like anti-racist, because I'm sure some of these people didn't think that they were racist. But like, maybe that isn't the right sort of correlation on this, but it's like, I could even see, oh, how about this? I could see people like in this category who, it's like people who were like, oh, I don't agree with slavery, but weren't necessarily like anti-abolitionist, right? Like, it's not enough to like, it's not enough. You have to be really against these really harmful practices.
Exactly. And you have to be actively against it. Yes. You can't be passively against it.
Right.
Because that nothing happens if you're just passively saying, I'm not racist, because you can say that and sit and do nothing.
Look, yeah, you're doing these really actually racist experiments. So I think you're sorry, Dr. Sally, but you need to turn this beat around and stop your weird ass experiments on my peoples.
So this mistrust was, it's not even Tuskegee. That wasn't even the first, you know, instance of it. It was rooted way before that. So some of these things are, again, I'm going to tell you that it's going to get depressing. It's going to get depressing. Black slaves were experimented on. We all know this from our, you know, research and educating ourselves.
Well, not everybody does. So you can teach the kids, because I think some people just think like, oh, they were just working up in the fields. They were experimented on, raped. Yeah. Like,
So they were forced murdered. Participation. In dissection and medical experimentation.
There's a kind of an American Horror Story subplot. I mean, not the best to get your history from, but there is a subplot in season 3 of American History about that very idea.
Black graves were always like constantly robbed to like for a continuous source for surgical or anatomical experiment. You know, there's like, you have a sacred thing where you buried your mom or dad or your family member, and those graves were robbed for experimentation.
That just made me think of like wanting to see Jordan Peele do a version of Frankenstein then. That's like of a black Frankenstein. Wouldn't that be interesting?
I mean, he'd be a great storyteller to tell that.
To tell that story. Yeah. That'd be really fascinating.
There's a psychiatric diagnosis of drapetomania. So I hope I'm saying it right. Which is, in other words, runaway slave syndrome.
Oh, I know
what
drapetomania. Oh, I've had drapetomania before. That's when you're like, oh, I can't get enough of Drake. And you are like, just so in love with.
Oh my God, stop.
Isn't that what drapetomania is? Like,
it's
you're like, ooh,
Drake.
I am. Oh, Drake. Oh, I heard
yeah,
Drake.
Yeah, drapetomania.
Like, oh, I thought it was like Drake. It's, like, I'm like, a lot of people get drapetomania.
It's the runaway slave syndrome, which this diagnosis, quote unquote diagnosis, was created. It was
you
created
just
to
free.
Basically, it was created to pathologize slaves who fled fled torture and inhuman situation under their owners, and running away from slavery was considered a disease. Can you imagine?
Oh my God, that's terrible. But you know why they do that? To be able to justify their actions.
Exactly. And then she got the treatment, the disease,
but she wants to just run away.
Yeah,
the treatment was shackles?
No, the treatment was worse than shackles. The treatment was often amputation of extremities. So...
Oh my God, it's like physical punishment. That will, you know what? That will, actually, I don't know that that will cure it, because I would still try to hobble my ass out of there.
But it's just...
It's horrific.
It's horrific. And so during the Reconstruction era, white American doctors argued that former slaves would not thrive in a free society because their mind could not cope with the psychological changes and the psychology of freedom.
Oh God, it's too much freedom. My like their brains would just like literally explode. They'd be like, okay, all right, John, all right, John, you can just go on ahead. What? Yeah. It's too much freedom. I can't handle this. Head explode. Oh, God.
Yeah, basically, that's what they're saying. It's ridiculous. And in the civil rights era...
Now I'm starting to not trust science and doctors. This is what they were picking up.
I know, and I'm in it. I can't believe it. I hope it's just, you know, I mean, it's changing.
This is the history.
I know. It's
sure.
Just
well,
is...
I like, we've come, a, we've come a long way from this and leeches. I'll say that.
but oh, my God. I mean... So in civil rights era, psychiatrists, again, used schizophrenia, to portray black activists as violent and hostile and paranoid because they threatened the racial status quo.
Right.
So, you know, they basically used all these, like, excuses and created diagnosis to vilify.
Which is why the same thing of, like, this is why they think there's so many black people who just don't trust therapy, right? Like, I understand that. Like,
this has, again, everything,
we can't just look at the cause of something. We can't just look at the symptom of it, that all of this is rooted. People are the way that they are because of past histories that have been inflicted upon them.
Yeah. So all of these I got from this article on The Hill, and also the article also referred to a few sources, and they're all like NIH published publications. So like, you know, these are coming from. I got the receipts. So if I will, you know, we will provide the listeners with the sources so that you can read them. And really, if you just Google, like, why don't black patients, like, you know, trust the medical professional or whatever, you'll get so many manuscripts that you can read. So that was like the history of it. And if you look at now, it's the implicit racial bias that's happening. Mm-hmm. And also, you know, we see lower triaging, like we triage people in ER and then we decide who goes to where, sort of.
Oh, yeah.
Black patients tend to have lower score because, the people who are evaluating are going off of their implicit bias.
And they probably have like a connection when they see like, you know, white suit Karen complaining in a bed. They're like, oh, she reminds me of my Aunt Karen. And then they're like, well, let's get her, because they feel a stronger connection.
Yeah. And in modern day psychiatry, black patients are given older medication with more side effects as opposed to like the newer ones with less. So like one of the examples that I found was that clozapine is less prescribed to minorities, even though it has better efficacy and is well tolerated. And, you know, it's kind of like why? You know, like I'm trying
yes,
to like
those are great
for
questions.
My thought of like, what does it cost you to do that? Like, you're doing it for a white patient. Why can't you do the same? Why is
that's
what it's not going to cost you anything to do the
same? That's how deep racism is embedded, that people don't even realize. That's when people are like, oh, I'm not racist. They don't understand what racism really is. They don't understand how ingrained it is into their way of life, their way of thinking, and their way of operating. And everything that you're saying really just makes me even that much more frightened. And when you look at the data of why Black people are dying at a larger rate and during this pandemic, and that happened during the 1918 pandemic. And this makes me really nervous for my community and my people who are going to need medical care right now.
Exactly.
And I don't have trust and faith that they're going to get the right medical care because of the other pandemic of racism.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, that's one of the things that this pandemic, the COVID-19 pandemic, brought out is the inequalities that's been here all this time.
Right.
It's just being highlighted now because we are forced to see it. We are forced to see it because the population that's dying or affected with COVID-19 are Black and brown people.
Right.
So on a little bit of a positive note.
Oh, okay. You didn't tell us we were going to get a positive note. You were like, hold on, this is going to be depressing, and it's going to be depressing. But we get a we get some ice cream.
Just a tiny bit.
Not even a scoop of ice cream. We get a Dippin' Dot, just a Dippin' Dot.
Yeah, you're going to get one Dippin' Dot.
I hate Dippin' Dots. But you know what? If I just had to eat sludge for a meal and then I was given one Dippin' Dot, I'd take it. So okay, let me get my Dippin' Dot.
So in the recent academic medicine, the academia basically have been focusing on health inequalities. So they are putting their attention. So medical school's curriculum includes courses on implicit bias and how to avoid it and how to kind of like change the way you see people, basically.
Gotcha. Like that class that I was being an actor in.
And then professional studies provided to current clinicians. So like, yes, we're doing this for like the upcoming clinicians, but we also need to go back and teach the old dogs new tricks, right?
Yeah,
So, you know, professional studies are being provided, and there, and also along with that, more studies are being done to show the disparity so that the medical professionals can see and look at hard evidence and see that, like, okay, there is a disparity. Like, it's not to say that, like, they don't see it without the hard evidence,
right.
But I think it just makes a stronger argument that like this is the proof, like you guys are doing this, so
people
let's change
sometimes
it.
Just need graphs and pie charts to just be exactly. Like that's what people need, facts and data, and this is exactly it. Okay, and that's great, but what's nice is y'all are in a scientific field, so you're able to like, all right, fine, we'll get you some pie charts and some data, here you go.
I mean, like, it's sad that we have to give you proof for humanity or having some sort of like goodness, but like if that's what's gonna work, people are, you know, there are plenty of scientists who are doing a lot of work to give everyone the hard evidence so that people can change.
Well, this has given me hope. Now, I was like, oh, I better not get the COVID. I'm
just
gonna die.
Just a little.
It does. And you know what? I give snaps because I would say you and your team of folks who are addressing these issues, and it gives me hope that I hope that there are other teams of folks who are working out there in the industry and the field. And it's, again, a great reminder of, like, no matter what your job or industry is, there is work to be done in dismantling.
There's always
racism is literally embedded in everything. It's a mold on this country that must be scraped off every last inch of it. And
it's everywhere.
I
mean, one of the things that one of the founders brought up was that, you know, like our website, our transplant center's website says, you know, we have all this like federally funded projects and federally funded research studies, and we are this big academia. Great. That's great. And it's a great transplant center if you need the care, right? But when Black people look at it, they see federally funded and they see government involvement, and they're like, I don't want that because, you know, few years ago, you guys did this. So
yeah, totally.
You know, there's
a stone's
ways
throw away.
Exactly. Yeah. And there's, so basically, you know, we were trying to figure out like the best way to do the outreach, but it gave me a chance to kind of learn more about what's happening and why it's happening. And so, yeah, it's been an eye-opening experience, and I wanted to share with you.
Well, thank you for taking me on that terrifying American... I feel like it's like the scary version of, like, I don't know, Grey's Anatomy or Chicago Hope, but you're giving me some hope here.
Yeah, a little bit of Dippin' Dot hope. But, I mean, anything... I think anything in medicine, to me... I mean, not only because I'm, you know, involved in this field, but also because I feel like when it comes to the well-being of a person, there's nothing scarier than like not being able to get the right treatment or, you know, there's nothing scarier than feeling like I'm being taken advantage of and I am not at my best and I'm sick. Like, that is the scariest thing. So yeah. When there is a shortcoming in this field, to me, it feels a lot more evil.
Yeah. I mean, it's a basic human sort of right. And again, it does look like there is a course correction that's happening there. And you're a part of it. You're being a part of the
change.
So good job to you. Kudos to Maury. And doctors, do it better.
Yeah, doctors are trying.
We interrupt the podcast you're listening to tell you about another podcast. That's right. We Got This with Mark and Hal.
That's correct, Mark. This is Hal. We do the hard work for you, settling all of the meaningless arguments you have with your friends.
So tune in every week on the Maximum Fun Network for We Got This with Mark and Hal. And all your questions will be asked and answered.
You're welcome. All right. That's enough of that.
We got this.
Whoosh. Okay, that is going to do it for us this week. Very excited to have you all back here on Tuesday. Get to kick off your week a little bit earlier with some brand new conversations coming at you. Yep, didn't say it. Like I said, Ben Randall's going to be here to help us digest the DNC highlights, and we're going to discuss our plans for action, how we are going to gear up and win this election, because we've got no other option here, folks. So here we go. We have the potential to have the beginning to the end of this nightmare. But let's face it, no matter what happens on January 20th, 2021, whoever is sworn in, and I am praying to the goddess that it will be Joe Biden and Kamala Harris and their amazing team, just envisioning who will be on that team. But it doesn't matter, because we know that the real work will just be beginning. We are making a lifelong commitment to the journey of equality and freedom, paving way for those who are about to come behind us, just as those who did before us. Really about just, I feel that when John Lewis passed, there was something about the torch. I feel it. And I hope you feel it too. And I know you do. That's why you're listening. That's why you're here. With great power comes great responsibility, and we do not take it lightly. Let's go. I love you all so much. And thank you so much for listening to Minority Corner, because together, we're the majority. Let's go.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Audience supported.